Hello, I'm Peter Martin from The Economy Stupid. It's your guide to the world of business, buying and decision making, and what it means for your mortgage, your job, your rent, and what you can afford. Because the economy isn't just out there, it's in here. It's in what we do. Search for The Economy Stupid and hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, the battle for the future of Hollywood. Paramount has launched a hostile takeover of Warner Brothers in an attempt to thwart a $100 billion sale to Netflix. So why should we care about the future of the film and streaming sectors, and how could it change what we see on screen? All of that is coming up. Then to federal politics, and Barnaby Joyce backs out of the National Party right into the arms of Pauline Hanson.
If you were playing for a football club and you were sitting on the reserve bench with them telling you that they wanted you to leave the club and you decided to go play football for another club, would that be an incredible insult? It's not as if I've resigned to go to the Labor Party or to the Greens.
You'll hear what the new One Nation MP told Melissa Clark. Then the government's teen social media ban comes into force this week. So how could it impact teenagers whose career is online? From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, it is a Hollywood drama for the ages. The battle for the future of the industry is really heating up this morning after Paramount mounted a hostile bid worth $108 billion US dollars for Warner Brothers Discovery. It comes just days after streaming giant Netflix agreed to buy out the media giant. Paramount says it's taking its bid straight to Warner Brothers shareholders, asking them to reject the Netflix deal valued at more than $70 billion US dollars. Now, both deals face a number of regulatory hurdles, the US President Donald Trump noting that the big market share could, quote, be a big problem. So, in the economics chair for Peter Martin this week is Evan Lucas. Here's his explanation of the deal on the table and just how much money we're talking about in Australian dollars.
They will offer for Warner Brothers Discovery, and I need to actually deliberately throw in the Discovery line there, an all-cash $30 US takeover. Now, that equates to $163 billion in terms of the takeover. Why it's hostile is that instead of getting the approval or going through a deal with the corporate management, the board, they are actually sidestepping them and going straight to shareholders. That's how a hostile taker works. And it will mean that they're actually buying the whole of the Warner Brothers Discovery studio assets. It's everything. That includes the cable, whereas the Netflix deal is not including that. It doesn't have the cable assets inside of it. So it's a really interesting, messy deal now that the Ellison family are going to ramp up quickly.
This is really interesting because Paramount's been trying to move into this space with Warner Brothers for a while. Mm-hmm. If their bid really is superior in value, in the certainty it can offer, why haven't Warner Brothers Discovery, why haven't they bought it? Why did they initially go with Netflix? What can we expect?
Yeah, so this is going to be the interesting sort of byproduct of all of this, is that Warner Brothers, as you rightly point out, Mel, actually put this deal to the board on the 1st of December and it was rejected. So the board did actually have this deal as pretty much its current setup. It rejected it from last week and went with Netflix because, in their view, it meant that they could still have some control of the legacy assets of the cable side. And that's what they want to keep. What Ellison at Paramount is arguing is that actually the better option is to keep the whole of Warner Brothers Discovery as a single entity rather than a broken up entity, and can therefore also make it much more regulatory compliant in terms of where it is. Because again, there is an argument that once you have, and this is Ellison's words in this, is that the number one streaming service and the number three streaming service, because HBO Max over in the US is the third largest streaming service, as one, the competition side of it goes by the wayside. Do need to point out that Paramount is actually second. So that's also an interesting point in terms of where it sits.
So that's not really going to be the arbiter necessarily. No. When it comes to managing this and trying to get through antitrust scrutiny.
Mel Clark there, speaking with Evan Lucas in our business and finance chair for Peter Martin. So Dawn Shimoleski is the US entertainment business correspondent for Reuters. She's also the author of the book Binge Times, covering this entire industry. And she explained just why this is such an interesting deal.
It is a pure cash offer, $30 a share, which is quite substantially more than Netflix is offered. Netflix is, by contrast, Netflix is offered around $28 a share in a mixture of cash and stock. Now, Paramount is saying to shareholders, look, we're the best steward for these assets. Not only will you get $18 billion more in cash from us, but we, you know, we're committed to continuing to release movies into theaters. In fact, on an investor call, David Ellison said, hey, look, we're going to release 30 movies into theaters annually, which would dramatically increase the volume of production, even for both of the combined studios. He said, look, and we're also going to create a more compelling streaming offer for consumers. We'll combine our Paramount Plus streaming service with HBO Max, and that will create a more robust alternative or competitor to either Netflix or Amazon. So that, he argues, will be good for consumers, so have more choice.
With either of these offers or attempts to take over Warner Brothers, would they be genuine mergers, or do you think either way it amounts to a takeover of some sort?
Well, it's definitely, Hollywood is definitely going through a constriction. That's a direct result of the streaming revolution that we all witnessed as consumers. The economics of the industry are upside down. The television business, which used to be the cash cow, is gone away. So. Traditional Hollywood studios have to change. Netflix is saying, look, this will be terrific. We'll continue to release movies, but we also have a streaming service that can help expose people to HBO content. You know, we've got a big global reach, so this would be great for everyone concerned. And Paramount, you know, is arguing it'll have a monopoly control over streaming and everyone will pay more. It's a really interesting battle that's shaping up.
It's such a change in the dynamic. Tell me more about the television side of this, because Warner Brothers owns CNN and Paramount's bid includes taking CNN on board, but I don't think Netflix's did. Can you explain that for me? What's the significance there?
I certainly can. So the Netflix bid assumes that Warner Brothers Discovery will take its collection of cable assets, which you mentioned includes CNN and TNT and some other assets, and spins that out as a separate publicly traded company. Look, Netflix has no interest in being in the traditional TV business. It's a streaming service, and it can see some benefit to releasing its movies into theaters and continuing to develop TV shows that are distributed at Netflix or elsewhere. Paramount says, hey, look, we think there's still intrinsic value in television networks. It owns CBS, a broadcast network. It owns other cable assets like Nickelodeon. It says by combining those with the television assets that Warner Brothers holds, that will be more valuable. That there still are pay TV distributors who are looking for this content, and that combined, it will have more clout in the marketplace. So two different views of the world.
Absolutely. So talk me through the regulatory hurdles that are in place here and what role there might be for the US president as he's looking at these attempts to take over.
Yeah. So any deal of this size is going to be subject to some sort of regulatory scrutiny. Likely Netflix's deal will come under scrutiny because of the concentration of the streaming market. You're taking the number one streamer in the U.S. and elsewhere around the world and combining it with the number three streamer. So does that give Netflix too much control over the market? And might that harm consumers? That'll be the question that regulators, at least here in the U.S., will look at. Paramount, meanwhile, will be combining a studio that looks substantially similar to itself. So it'll be combined film studios and television studios and streaming services. So the regulators will take a look at whether this gives it too much concentration. Now, Paramount argues it's already got that addressed. Its biggest investor, Larry Ellison, is close to President Donald Trump, and they think this will have fewer regulatory hurdles than Netflix will confront.
Dawn Shimoleski is the US entertainment business correspondent at Reuters. She's also the author of the book Binge Times. It's been a pretty big 24 hours in federal politics. Barnaby Joyce successfully leaping off the National Party beam and landing on the crossbar of One Nation. All right, that's a pretty awful gymnastics analogy, but you get the picture. Before we hear from Mr. Joyce, our political reporter, Evelyn Manfield, can bring us up to speed.
This has been going on for a while now.
It does feel like it's been dragging on a bit.
It does. Net zero was a real driving factor for why he wanted to leave. He wanted the coalition to ditch net zero. Of course, it eventually did. But we know he was also really unhappy with his where he sat in Parliament, his position on the backbench. But what I think is going to be really interesting is his end goal, which is eventually to run for One Nation to win a New South Wales Senate seat. So he is moving in his seat in the House for New England. He is moving from the Nationals to One Nation. But this idea of the Senate, I think, is really interesting because, as we know, Labor's got such a big majority in the House that his vote there isn't going to matter as much. But in, you know, a new Parliament in the future, he would like to eventually hold power in the Senate, you know, which you're able to do. So that will be really interesting when that eventuates. But some of the comments he was making last night in an interview with 7:30 was also interesting because he was comparing One Nation's rising popularity to some of these movements we're seeing globally. You know, you look with the Reform Party in the UK with Nigel Farage, the MAGA movement in the US as well. And he was saying that he thinks Australia is sort of behind the eight ball in this way, that, you know, he's clearly signalling he thinks there's momentum for One Nation to gain. And we heard the same from Pauline Hanson yesterday as well, saying that One Nation has set up something like 70 branches around the country now.
It's really interesting, given there's such contested views about whether or not those right-wing populist parties overseas, whether that could or couldn't be replicated here in Australia. How are the Nationals responding to Barnaby Joyce jumping ship?
They're not happy, which isn't a surprise. But David Littleproud, the Nationals leader, he made quite a scathing comment. He said that he's turned his back on the Nationals, instead joining a party of protest which is never able to achieve anything other than headlines. We also heard from Kevin Hogan, the deputy leader of the party, saying that he'd spoken to members and voters in Mr. Joyce's seat of New England. They weren't happy with it. We know that some of his sort of allies in the party, like Matt Canavan, had tried to get him to stay. So look, this isn't great for the Nationals. They've already seen Jacinta Namper-Jimper-Price in the Northern Territory move to the Libs. Of course, that's not as significant still being in the coalition. But last term, they lost Andrew Gee also to become an independent. So the coalition has been facing a lot of problems, really, an election loss, losing people, you know, losing voters in inner city seats as well. It's been a tough time for them.
Evelyn Manfield there. So, a tough time for the coalition, but a very, very busy morning for Barnaby Joyce. Fresh off that decision, he'd booked in a full diary of interviews this morning. We'd hoped to spend considerable time with him, but we only managed to get hold of him a few minutes before we went off air. So, not your usual political interview, but still, a chance to gauge the temperature and hear from the man himself. Here were the questions that Mel Clark was able to put to Barnaby Joyce.
Can you tell me, what's your message today to your New England constituents? They re-elected you as a National Party candidate just 7 months ago. How are you explaining this to them?
Okay, let's go through this in part. Number one, okay?
Yep.
I am not standing for New England again. I've been saying that for quite some time. Number two, I've left a substantial amount of money in the Nationals' account for them to campaign, so I think I've been fair through there. Number three, subsequent to the election, it became quite apparent that my relationship with the leadership of the National Party in the House of Representatives had irreparably broken down. That could be seen by your listeners and such things as being asked to move on for generational change. I think that's a pretty, if anybody in a relationship they were in was told that they had to move on for generational change, I don't think they'd be having to go to AI to work out exactly what that meant. That was also by just in the visual impact, you can basically say he was moved to the back corner of the parliament underneath the exit sign as a metaphorical, clear statement of what they wanted you to do. And even on a puerile form, but nonetheless, it gives you another example, never given a question in about 1.5 years. I think the best way for your listeners to understand it, if you were playing for a football club and you were sitting on the reserve bench with them telling you that they wanted you to leave the club and you decided to go play football for another club in the same region, would that be an incredible insult? It's not as if I've resigned to go to the Labor Party or to the Greens. I'm on the same side of the political fence, and I think that explains it as best I can. If it's hurt people, I apologise. deeply, but there's that was a, it was to, if you want to continue on in politics and serve your nation, it was the most efficacious way to do it.
Are you taking those moves that have put you on the back bench and, you know, seated out on the edge of the parliamentary benches, are you taking that too personally? I mean, Michael McCormack is likewise being put to the back bench and he doesn't feel the need to switch parties.
He's actually further in than I am. I'm at the very edge. I'm in the ejector seat. Okay? Make no mistake about it. Go to Eclipse, have a look.
What, so if, and, if you were one seat further over, would that have been different?
No, it's just, I'm just saying it's quite apparent what this means, and you know, I have to make a decision about what's the most effective way to look after, number one, those who have a laser-like focus on, which is the people of New England. I did this announcement in New England.
But
not
you can
in,
do that. We can do that from the backbench. I mean, backbenchers do good work representing their constituents.
The most, I said, the most effective way to do this. And obviously, if you want to get the other alternative, of course, was just to resign from Parliament. To be quite frank, I think that's what people wanted.
You're not done, though.
No, I'm not. Absolutely not. As I've said, I'm 58, not 85. And there is more work to do. I believe, number one, something that I'll say to you as I have to read on ABC Stable this morning, the fact that we have intermittent power swindle, putting wind towers, solar panels, transmission lines for the benefit, not of your listeners, but of billionaires, domestic billionaires, tiny state-owned organisations, overseas multinationals, which is putting up the price of your power and doing nothing for the climate is an outrage. And the more we can do to basically bring daylight to this and to basically bring a better standard of living by reducing the cost of electricity to your listeners is a good thing. All they're doing at the moment is they're covering up their swindle by basically inferring a sense of guilt on your listeners that if you don't agree with them ripping you off, you're somehow a bad person who doesn't believe in climate change.
All right, Barnaby. Well, I appreciate you speaking to us as well as our other ABC colleagues this morning. We'll leave it there and let you get on with your day. Thank you very much.
Mel Clark there, ending that interview with One Nation MP Barnaby Joyce. So, as you could hear, not quite getting enough time for pushback to some of those comments, but still worth hearing Barnaby Joyce's response to those questions, particularly around his New England electorate who put him in Parliament. Well, millions of Australian children are preparing for their social media feeds to go dark as the federal government's social media ban for under 16s kicks in tomorrow. Yesterday, we heard from a digital welfare expert about how parents can speak to their children ahead of the ban. But what happens if your child's social media is also their career? Abby is the 15-year-old sports commentator behind the popular Her Way sports media platform. Her dad, Chris, manages her accounts. They both spoke to Mel this morning, and Abby explained just how she currently uses social media.
So social media has been a pretty important part of Her Way since it started in 2021. So me and my parents, we opened the social media Instagram account, I think, right at the end of 2021, just to do a few posts, maybe a couple of photos of athletes that I had had. But then it started to gain a following pretty quickly, which I was pretty surprised by. And so it's kind of become a pretty crucial part of what Her Way does today. So posting the links to longer interviews and sharing content and posting tiles about things that may have happened in women's sport that are quite significant. So it's definitely a pretty key part of Her Way. But my dad and my mum have also helped me a lot in managing the account, specifically my dad who manages it. So I don't, it is, the ban is probably, yeah, going to not affect me too much, but maybe the following a bit.
What do you think though, as a young person, you know, aside from your, you know, sports reporting and using these platforms to do it, what do you think about the idea of having a government directive to stop young people from using social media? Do you think it's a good idea in theory?
You know, kids are pretty smart. They might find ways to go around it by creating accounts or other accounts not under their own name so that they can go undetected. And I've even heard a couple of my friends even right now that have spoken to me saying that they found ways to get around the ban. So I'm not sure if it'll work, but I guess we'll have to wait and see. But also I think social media, while there are some bad parts, there's also some good parts. Like a lot of kids that may live in like rural areas, they might need social media to connect to their friends. Like while I've been doing, I do online school. So social media helps me to connect to some of my friends that I don't get to see every day. So that's that's probably an aspect that they'll probably lose, as well as connecting with their favourite creators and a lot of athletes also that are on social media.
Chris, you run Abby's professional social media accounts with your wife. You're really involved with this. So perhaps you're in a really good position to tell us about the sort of conversations that you have in your household about social media and how to use it safely.
Our girls are quite level-headed and really sensible girls, and it's never been an issue, this whole conversation, and there's no, we haven't had to fight back about anything or anything, and I think we're all on the same page too, that, as Abby said, we kind of understand that, we all want kids to be taken care of and looked after, but is this the right way to go about it? And I think education more than just legislation is the way to just keep kids understanding why things are good, why they're bad, what are the good parts of social media, what are the things to be aware of and the dangers. And we've certainly tried to, the whole way along since day one, just make our girls aware of that.
Chris, you and Abby announced on social media recently that her accounts would continue to be parent managed even after Abby turned 16. What sort of response did you get from the followers from that?
So we wanted to assure them that, we've gone about things the right way, and Abby doesn't even know the passwords to some of the social media accounts, let alone go on them. We had everyone from the Federal Communications Minister liking that post through to a lot of athletes and sports organisations. A lot of the comments on that post were basically parents and mums and grandmothers and whatever saying, look, it's glad to hear you guys are going about this way and showing the way to do it, that parents can work with their kids to manage it safely and execute what we're doing in a way that is safe for everybody.
And Abby, your audience has been supportive of how you've managed your approach to using social media?
We got a pretty good response from putting out that post just to let people know that I wasn't actually managing the social media myself, so that I could focus on other aspects of Herway, such as the journalism and going to games. So it seems like everyone was really supportive of that and thinking that it was the right way that we were doing it. So, I mean, it's also a good way to make sure that we're not being banned for half a year before I turn 16 next year, so people can keep following the content, which is good.
And Abby is the 15-year-old sports commentator behind the popular Her Way sports media platform, and her dad Chris, who manages all of her accounts. With that ban coming in tomorrow, we'll be taking another look at what that means on tomorrow's episode of The Breakfast Wrap. But thank you for listening to today's edition. Every interview was presented by Melissa Clark, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Ted O'Connor. You can hear us every morning at 11:30 a.m. on Radio National, or a little bit earlier if you're listening on the ABC Listen app. And if that is where you're finding us, you can hit follow on the Radio National Breakfast page, and you'll see the Breakfast Wrap episode pop up at the top of the stream every morning. But if you are listening to us elsewhere, hit subscribe, give us a review, tell your mates or your mum about us. I'm sure they'd love to know. Thanks again for listening. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and we'll see you tomorrow.